Good Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a pretty good start so far this morning. 10:06 is our time right now. Hi there, and welcome to the second hour of the show. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Dr. Rob is settling in this hour for another edition of Science Files. It's our weekly look at news from the world of science, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, it's your turn to sound off this morning. We're going to the phones next hour for Manic Monday. It's our first open hour of the week, and of course, as always, in our open hours, anything goes. And after the news at noon, Cape Breton University political scientist Tom Urbaniak joins me to discuss the two upcoming provincial by-elections, March 10th. Both ridings were held by New Democrat MLAs, and a lot's riding on that party now in these two votes. And we'll hear another Halifax History Moment this afternoon with historian and author Blair Bede. But this hour, it is time for Science Files, and joining me this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
And how are you doing today?
Not too bad.
Good.
Quite sore, as I just mentioned, but
yeah,
that's all my fault for getting up and working out so early.
Doing some weightlifting, I guess, or something. How much can you lift? What are you pressing?
Bench press, on a one rep, I could probably do about 200.
Really?
But I don't usually do that high. I do about 165, 170 normally.
I'm about 200, so you could lift me high above your head.
I'd rather not do that, but not high above my head. No, I couldn't clean and press you, Rick.
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. I want to talk about this American astronaut who's just back.
Christina Koch.
After 11 months, I believe?
328 days.
On the International Space Station, the longest ever for a female astronaut.
Yep.
And apparently gravity and the effects of space are different on a woman's body than a men's body.
So absolutely.
What do we know about the difference right now?
You know what? I'm not too sure. I was actually trying to do some research on this before I got in, but there was a bunch of other things I was looking at. But it's certainly the case that it's been pointed out by a number of experts that if you look at the amount of long-term research that's been done on the human body, it's mostly been done on men, right? And so in particular, women, like the few things that I do know about, I mean, in particular, bone density in women is obviously a concern, osteoporosis and things like that. And you get a similar kind of thing happening in space potentially. So this is really, really important for us to study in terms of understanding how women's bodies fare in zero gravity versus men. And so this is a really, really important thing to do. And so it's good to see. I mean, only Scott Kelly has been up there longer as far as for U.S. session. For astronauts in general, I think there was some Russian Polyakov who was up for like 430 days on Mir or something like that. But anyway, no, this is really important because men's and women's bodies are different. They work in somewhat different ways if you look at all of the hormone levels and so on. So understanding the impacts of zero G on those two separate sexes is important.
Yeah, they compared Scott Kelly with his identical twin brother
after he
came back, and they found some differences. So he had actually shrunk, or was it he had grown a bit?
No, he would grow a bit because your spine is not compressed in zero G, whereas it is compressed.
But he would return to normal once he was back on Earth for a period of time?
Yep. So and so the things that were interesting was what's called the gene expression was different. So the way that the proteins were being formed from DNA and things like that was somewhat different for Scott Kelly versus his brother Mark. And so, but that all sort of like changed back as well after a while too.
Interesting. So DNA, actually, there was changes to
his DNA? Well, no, it's not actually the DNA technically, because people were saying, oh, he's kind of mutated in space, but that's not really what happens. DNA controls how you produce certain proteins in your body as well. And so that side of it was different. It's called the gene expression.
Okay. But again, who do they compare this American female astronaut to now? I
mean, well, they're not, but that's you can do comparative studies like they did with Mark and Scott, or you can do just independent studies where you look at a specific individual. So that's what they'll have been doing with Christina Koch.
I'm interested to see what they discover.
Yeah.
10:10 is the time right now. Europe and NASA's solar orbiter has blasted off on what's described here as an unprecedented mission to capture the first pictures of the sun's poles. The $1.5 billion spacecraft will join NASA's Parker Solar Probe in coming perilously close to the sun to try and unveil its secrets.
Burning to a crisp.
Yeah.
No, I mean, this is a companion, I would say, mission to the Parker Solar Probe. The Parker Solar Probe is going in really close. It's getting within 11 million kilometers, which is just a handful of diameters, literally. And so Solar Orbiter is not going to get in quite so close. It's going to be about 40 million kilometers away, but it's going to be able to see the poles as well. And it will do something that Parker doesn't do, and that is it will take images. Parker really doesn't do that because it's behind this great big...
Well, who took those images we talked about last time?
So that was Deakyst. Okay. So that was the new Daniel K. Inouye telescope in Hawaii.
Right.
So that will take really amazing pictures of the sun, but it can only do it around the sort of like equatorial to slightly sort of like going up towards the poles, whereas the solar orbiter will be able to do the poles themselves.
So the sun has a north and south pole, basically?
Oh, yeah, it's spinning,
Similar to Earth's poles are obviously much
different. Well, I mean, poles just is a term used for determining the axis of spin,
So what's not a magnetic field or anything like
that? Well, the sun does have a magnetic field, but the sun's magnetic field is very complicated, right? Very complicated. I mean, you see the complicated nature of the sun's magnetic field when you look at its surface with all of these what we call flux tubes, right, and sort of poking up at the surface and so on. It's really complicated, much more complicated than the Earth's magnetic field.
Says here, the spacecraft will fly past Venus and then maneuver into a unique out-of-plane orbit that will take it over both poles.
Yeah.
Any idea how long is the journey to the sun?
That's a good question. I don't know. I wouldn't think it's going to take as many orbital adjustments as Parker did. Parker is on this whip-around orbit.
Yeah.
But typically, to get on station, it'll be a few months, I would guess.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones here. And our friend Bob is back with us this morning with a question. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
We're doing well.
Doctor, I have a lot of questions, but I know that
stick to one. Stick to one.
I'm going to get at it right away. And you have to admit, Doctor, that it's not the questions; it's the possibilities and the debates.
The curiosity is the key thing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Rick, you hear him?
I hear you. Now let's hear your question.
Rick's curious.
Yeah, I know.
He's a curious fellow.
I'm interested in galaxies.
Yep.
And also, the fact I'm interested in galaxies and some of my research, is there a particular, I mean, there's many galaxies out there. Is there a particular galaxy that scientists are looking at than any other galaxy to give us a lot of questions about if there's life out there? That's my point.
Okay.
And I'm going to leave that point with you, but my research is also interesting because I have come to a conclusion that we, and get rid of TV and all the fantasies about space.
Yeah.
I've come to a conclusion that there is a darn good possibility that we have been visited. And that'll be future question or future interest.
Well, if you tell me your address, Bob, I'll come and visit you.
Listen, and I'm both getting in shape.
All right.
I know you're a golfer and a very good golfer. And I was just talking to a friend last night, and he's a very good golfer in Ontario. And I told him that I hit 100 once, and I was so excited. And then he had to remind me that that was on 9 holes.
I was going to say, then they'll let you play the other 9.
Thanks for the question, Bob, as always. You have an answer for it.
So I'll get back to the first part of Bob's question about galaxies and life. And so the short answer is galaxies are so far away that when you start looking for life, you're really looking too far away when you look at galaxies. Galaxies are literally, I would put them in the context of being... millions is probably an exaggeration, but they're hundreds of thousands of times further away, or even millions of times in some cases, than our nearby stars. So if you're going to look for life, and the way we really want to look for life is to look at the atmospheres of planets around other stars, right? Because you're going to go and look for things like oxygen, which suggests that there's some kind of living thing constantly putting oxygen into the atmosphere, because oxygen really likes to react. Like, if you have something that doesn't have any life, you would expect most of that oxygen would have reacted with something. So that kind of thing we're going to do around stars in the nearby solar neighborhood. We're not going to be looking at galaxies for that kind of thing. Now, do scientists study one galaxy in particular? Or kind of, yes, we do.
Yeah, there is one in particular.
Well, the Andromeda Galaxy is the nearest big spiral galaxy, and we spend a lot of time looking at that. It's quite unusual in terms of its inner structure. And so we spend a lot of time looking at that. We've done amazing surveys of it with the Hubble Space Telescope and other space telescopes as well. So we know an awful lot about Andromeda M31. And of course, we will be colliding with it in about 5 billion years as well. So that is the one galaxy that we probably spend most of our time looking at. But there are other galaxies as well. M87 galaxy, a giant elliptical galaxy, that gets a lot of interest as well. But in terms of concluding that we have been visited... well, okay, Bob. I don't think that's a good conclusion on the basis of the evidence we have, but you're okay to jump to your conclusions.
But we do know that there are, again, Earth-like planets in habitable zones.
We do know that. Yeah. Indeed, we do. Yes.
And which leads to speculation that
Could. I mean, there was life on this planet very quickly in the sort of geological history of our planet. It was within like 500 million years of the planet forming. Right. The difficult step, as we keep on talking about, the difficult step is going from like very basic bacteria life up to the complex cells that make advanced life. Oh, I say advanced. Am I calling myself advanced? I shouldn't do that. But anyway, but make higher forms of life like you and I as well. And that was a really tricky thing that took a long period of time. Right. But we do think, in all probability, simple single cell life may well actually be somewhat common out there in the rest of the universe.
Well, we know there are a couple of moons, for example, are they Jupiter's moons, Saturn's moons, that Euripides or Europa or something?
Enceladus.
Enceladus, thank you.
And Europa, yeah.
With water there that they think might...
Yeah, it's a possibility. I mean, you have water, you have a heat source or an energy source, and so people sort of speculate. I mean, I'm not sold on that. I actually have a bet with a graduate student about where we find the first evidence of life elsewhere off the Earth. And so she's betting on icy moons, and I'm betting on finding it around planets around other stars.
Interesting.
Right?
Interesting.
And we have two bottles of wine that are in a safe, and... Hopefully, they will get opened within our lifetimes.
Hopefully. That'd be very interesting. 10:18 is the time. He is Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files on a Monday morning. And let's see, Rick, stay there. You're coming up. We've got Barry on hold. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, give us a call here this morning at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We're back with more Science Files right after this quick break. And 21 on a Monday morning with Dr. Rob Thacker in Science Files, and Rick's on the line with a question for us this morning. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Did you play that music for me?
ask Katie. Katie, did you play the music just for Rick?
Did. Okay. She knows I have the Star Wars birthday.
There you go.
Anyway, the sun, it rotates on an axis, correct, Dr. Rob?
Yep.
Okay. Is it the sun output equal at the poles as it is at the equator? That's my question. I'll hang up and listen, okay?
All right, thanks, Rick. Dr. Rob, tough question.
I haven't really thought about that. I know my colleagues who work on stars would know about that. So the sun isn't a perfect sphere, so if you look at it from a slightly different direction... you'll see different overall sizes and outputs. But, you know, off the top of my head, I don't actually know. I would, at first order, they've got to be fairly similar. But in terms of the overall movement of energy to the poles, I would guess that there could be some differences because of the spin. But, you know, I don't know. And because I'm a scientist... I'm not going to speculate.
Well, you're going to go find out.
I'm going to find out,
Okay, report back to us at a future date. 10:23, Dominic just emailed to say he understands that you don't think it's likely we've been visited by extraterrestrial life, but he is wondering if you could explain how you feel about the whole UFO investigation phenomenon, not so much in terms of how likely their conclusions are, but in terms of their general impact on culture and science.
Oh, wow.
That's a big question, yeah.
Where to begin?
Yeah,
I mean, movies, TV shows.
That's right.
The Rick Howe Show. No, just kidding.
No, but I mean, I'm as fascinated as anyone with this
stuff. The cultural impact has been huge, but I mean, I think that we all love escapism.
Yeah.
And this feeds into that. This feeds into the idea that somehow the universe has all of these secrets that we don't know about. So I think that really appeals to a lot of people as well. And the thing that I try to make people think about is the fact that our universe is amazing, right? And so it's like, I remember giving a talk at a Café Scientifique when I had a young gentleman come up to me afterwards and he was saying, what do you think about crystal power? And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, I want to sit inside a pyramid and that will make me feel better. And I was just sort of like a little bit dismayed because I know why he was saying this. He wanted to believe in something that was different from reality and something that he could believe in, for want of a better term. And so I had a discussion with him and I said, well, you know, if you eat really healthily, that will probably make you feel a bit better.
No question.
Right? And so the world itself is really amazing. And we kind of lose sight of that. We kind of think it's every day because that's literally where the term comes from. But you just break a piece of grass and you look at that piece of grass, there's physics going on in that. There's chemistry going on in that. There's all of these incredible things that we just don't think about, right, that are really just amazing. I think perhaps maybe we express that amazement in terms, for some people, in religion and things like that, that there has to be something behind this.
Yeah.
But in terms, coming back to UFOs, I mean, it has had a huge, huge impact. And in some ways, the onset of social media has amplified that as well. So we're now in a situation where people get their news from social media, and that means that the news that they may be getting is not always passed in the same way as we would expect reputable journalists to pass things.
But do you think that people want to believe in life out there?
Well, that's a different question. I think people do want to believe that there is life elsewhere out there. And I think logic and our sort of like scientific basis does suggest that that's probably true. But what our scientific basis doesn't really have much evidence for or reason to believe is the concept of aliens having come here, right? That's where we sort of like run out of evidence, as it were.
But if you watch the History Channel, just saying.
It's aliens.
It's they got all kinds of alien shows. 1025, 1025 is what I'm saying here.
It's the History Channel.
I know. Ron emails, does Dr. Thacker have any opinion on FRB 180916.JO158+65? Wow.
Oh, that's the repeater, isn't
it? Yeah, which seems, he says, to be received now on a 16.35-day cycle. He's talking about fast radio bursts that are coming in on a regular basis every 16.35 days.
Yeah,
what do you make of this?
So background to this is, so fast radio bursts are these very rapid millisecond bursts of radio. And for a while, we didn't have very many of them. They were found primarily by the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia. But the Chime Radio Telescope in Penticton, BC, British Columbia, which is a great Canadian experiment, has been finding lots of these. It's really kind of vacuuming up the field.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's really leading the way. And so this particular FRBs are sort of like were for a long time unpredictable. Then we found one repeating, and this is a new repeater that's very regular. And so this suggests that whatever is powering the radio burst is kind of ongoing in a constant way. Like there could be material flowing off a companion star onto a neutron star and creating a flare or something like that. But whatever is happening, it's happening on a regular basis. And so that gives people freedom for thinking about what this could be. But there's probably a number of possible scenarios for what this actually is.
Is mechanical possibility?
No, this is the likely to create this much energy in such a short period of time. You're looking at things that are very dense. So it's probably related to a neutron star or possibly even a black hole or something like that. I don't know for sure. I haven't had a chance to go into detail looking at this paper, but it basically means that there is something going on in that system that is repeating a consistent piece of physics, and that gives the modelers something to aim at, literally. You can say, well, what kind of processes do we know that are regular? And you can go and you can look at all of those, and then you can start putting things together. But my guess would be there's some kind of maybe companion sort of like flowing material onto it, but it could be that there's basically stuff that's just slowly going down onto this thing as well. So it's tough to say.
Interesting. 10:28 is the time. Barry, stay there. You're coming up next. I've got a couple of email questions that are in as well. But first we have to take a break. We've got a news update coming up for you at the bottom of the hour. Then more Science Files with Dr. Rob. We'll be back after the news, and the news is coming up next. 10:32 here on a Monday morning. Science Files underway till 11 o'clock. Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University is my guest. He's an astrophysicist, and he's here to answer your questions. And you can give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. In fact, let's go to Mark here on email, who says he believes the Earth is protected by solar flares by its magnetic field. Is that correct? Yeah, okay. He says, is it possible that a solar flare of enormous energy could ever penetrate this field and wreak havoc on Earth?
Oh, yes.
Really?
And that's happened.
Oh, has it?
Right, yes. I mean, that happens every few decades, I would say.
But wreak havoc makes it sound almost...
Well, yeah, it can.
Calamity. But yeah. We're not at that, are we?
Well, no. But so you remember there was the Quebec grid was taken down? About 1988 or something like that.
Okay.
Right. And so that's what happens, because what you literally get is you get all of these charged particles coming from the sun, and any moving charged particle creates electric currents, right? And so if you have enough of this come through the space from the sun to the Earth and actually hit our magnetic field, it gets funneled down and it will basically start moving the magnetic field lines. And as those magnetic field lines are moved, they'll start creating currents in any long piece of metal.
Oh, okay.
What are power lines?
Yeah, seriously.
Long pieces of metal.
Yeah.
So you will start inducing currents in those. And so that is a concern and has actually had an effect. But what would be a pretty, really quite scary thing is if we went back to the 1859 Carrington event, right, which was the biggest solar flare we've ever had, that actually had a situation where it was inducing currents that were so strong in the telegraph of the time that literally there were sparks flying around and it was running without the normal batteries it would have.
What would have been today that impact?
Well, that is a very good question. And so if something like that happened today, there would probably be significant damage to like substation generators and things like that, as well as potentially power lines themselves as well. So that would be something pretty dangerous. We do have ways of protecting to a certain extent. You can actually have capacitor banks, and you can also disconnect things as well. But it's not easy to do. And so there's a lot of research being done on this as well.
Can we forecast these flares at all, these solar flares?
No. We only know what the best thing that we can do is to know when they're coming.
Yeah.
Right. And so we will have a few days notice normally when something goes off, because it takes a fair amount of time for them to get here. But no, this is a serious piece of research to figure out how we can protect all of our power infrastructure from these types of events.
I remember back in the olden days of radio when we relied a lot on the satellite transmission for the news wire and such, that we were always warned, the broadcast news would always give us a warning, solar flares expected this week, and look for interruptions, interference on our, you know, on our feed and stuff like that. So this would affect electronics and such.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So one of my concerns, and it may be irrelevant, but one of my concerns is that with all of these proposed satellite constellations, right, you'll have thousands of satellites up there, and I want to know how well protected those particular individual satellites are against these kind of events. Because if we actually had a situation where a whole bunch of those went defunct because they got hit with a solar flare,
they'd all tumble to Earth, would they?
They would eventually, but for a long time, you've got a bunch of things that you can't steer, don't collision avoid, and so on, and are about 500 kilometers up there. So that's a question I'd like an answer to. And now, it might not be an issue, right? They might have good protection against that. One would expect that they would kind of design for that as well.
But you also gave me a link to a story. Satellites and space debris are polluting our orbit. And so we're sending more and more of this stuff up there into space. And so I guess, you know, the possibilities are...
Okay, let's do this one. Because this is actually... I'm currently the president of the Canadian Astronomical Society, and we put out a position statement last week, which we sent to the press as well. So I did a couple of interviews about it. And so what's happening is we're going from a situation where we have like a couple of thousand, maybe a little bit more, satellites that are operational up there, to people saying that they want to fly 40,000, right? And so... Admittedly, SpaceX is saying we'll start with 12,000 and then maybe we'll look at putting the other 30,000 up there. And so, yes, of course, they're doing something that would be nice to have, global satellite internet. That's would be great to have. And so, but the thing is, if you have just 1% of these fail, right, you've got a bunch of things that are flying around potentially causing damage. Then you're going to have competitors in the space. right? So it's not going to be just Starlink. There's going to be OneWeb. There probably might be Samsung as well. There will be a number of different companies that all want to compete within a certain orbital range to have their satellites in that space. And, you know, if you have a collision, then that debris field actually will tend to knock things up and down and to the sides and so on. So it will go up into higher orbits and so on. So this is a concern. And one of the things that people are writing about is we've got to think how we're going to bring this stuff down.
Yeah.
Right. Deorbiting below 500 kilometers is not too big a deal in some sense that if something went really, really wrong at 500 kilometers, that stuff's probably coming down within about 10 years anyway. So if we had a disaster, nature will save us. But that shouldn't be where we go, right? That shouldn't be where we go. We should be thinking about these. And so Musk has said, well, you know, we'll have all our collision avoidance stuff and so on. And that's all well and good. And I've read papers. We talked about Kessler syndrome. So Donald Kessler wrote a paper with a telecoms company saying, if you have collision avoidance, this will be fine. But things break, right? They lost 3 Starlink satellites in the first batch they sent up. Right. And so this is a concern. Right. And I'm not even talking about the stuff that we're concerned about as astronomers, of how bright these things are, sort of like twilight. I mean, literally, as the sun starts going down and just disappears beyond the horizon, these things will light up.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, we mentioned last week the two satellites that the two defunct satellites
nearly
collided could have been a real issue up there. The International Space Station orbits above all that space junk, typically, does it not?
No. The International Space Station, if I remember, is something around that height. It's quite low. It was being repositioned by when they sent the shuttle up every now and again. So it does have an orbit that decays.
All right, back to the phones to go. By the way, Ken just tweeted to say former NASA astronauts Gordon Cooper and Edgar Mitchell are all on record saying they've actually seen UFOs and they believe in them. And I believe it was former Canadian Defense Minister, what was his name suddenly? I'm having a brain fart here. Paul Hellyer.
I was going to say Peter McKenna.
Well, I don't know what Peter's views are on UFOs, but Paul Hellyer, while a Liberal cabinet minister in the Pearson government, very much believed in UFOs and such.
Well, look, okay, it's one thing. Okay, this is the whole thing of what a UFO is, right? So UFOs, there are these things out there in the skies, radar signals that we don't understand. Yes, I accept that, right? They are unidentified flying objects. That is a given. But then to jump from the conclusion that those things are somehow aliens from another planet visiting us, I think that's just...
Barry, good morning to you.
Good morning. You know, Saturday, if you wanted to fly south for some warm temperature, you could go all the way to Antarctica.
Oh, yeah.
Degrees. I mean, that's the warmest they've ever recorded. And we also know now that the ice is melting from underneath and on top.
Yep.
There's no guarantee that this temperature rise is going to be incrementally. We could hit a point where it could just take off. Mm-hmm. This is more serious than people even dreamed a few years ago, isn't it?
It is, and I think appreciate it, Barry. Thanks.
Actually, you're touching on the thing that is really the sort of scientist's nightmare. And so there's been a lot of pushback, people saying, you know, you scientists, you're just making a lot of fuss. You're trying to get attention, right? You're blowing things out of proportion. Like, you just want to get more money. You're all in it. You're all in cahoots together. Scientists in general are actually pretty conservative people, right? You don't want to say something that turns out to be wrong if you're a scientist.
Yep.
Right? And so the nightmare scenario with global warming is, in fact, that we're all erring on the side of underpredicting what's going to happen. Right? And now, I'm not going to say that's what's happening, but that's the nightmare scenario. Right? And so in particular with glacier stability and things like that, then all of the melt, all of the stuff that Jim Hansen has been talking about, the NASA climatologist, this is a real concern, that things may be going far faster than we actually realize, right? And may be coming unstable faster than we actually realize. So with Antarctica, that's an amazing temperature. It is summer down there. Let's get that straight. It is summer down there. But it's the highest temperature that they've ever recorded down there. And that follows on the back of the highest temperatures ever recorded at the North Pole as well. Right? So that was about a year ago, whatever it was.
In the past decade, the warmest temperatures ever recorded in recorded history on this planet.
So the big concern here is that the train has left the station and we're not going to be able to stop it.
I saw a video on the weekend, a big chunk of Antarctica, a big chunk of ice broke off.
So, I mean, there's always stuff breaking off Antarctica.
This is especially large, this one.
But what they're concerned about right now is the western ice shelf, which is actually kind of anchored to the sea floor. It's below sea level. It's anchored to where it's anchored. It's anchored to the seafloor. And so they're worried that if that was to actually end up all moving away, and the likelihood of that is fairly small, but it's not zero. But if that actually did become unstable and literally sort of like moved away and broke off, then I think the estimate is something like half a meter of sea level rise.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
10:43 is the time right now. Ken tweets with a question, I guess. He says he's heard physicist Michio Kaku and Brian Green recently say time travel to the past is believed to be possible. He's wondering if you've got any comments on that. And he attaches a tweet from Dr. Kaku, who says, is time travel possible? I was asked. Perhaps was his answer.
Well,
what are your thoughts?
So there are solutions in Einstein's theory of general relativity that do allow you to time travel, right? And there's a concept called closed time-like curves. And once you establish these particular closed curves, they literally loop back in time, right? So you have to establish a point in your timeline, and then once it's established, you can come back to that point from the future, right? It's not, as far as I'm aware, possible to go arbitrarily back in time, right? You have to sort of like establish a window, and then you can go back to that from a later date. Right?
Can you be specific about what time you'd want to go back? So, for example, could I go back and watch my birth if I wanted? Or would I just be a hit and miss?
If you had a physics relative, a physicist relative, and she set up the beginning of that closed time-like curve at the point you were being born, in theory, yes, that could happen.
Really?
Yeah. But it completely messes up with causality. We don't really... The fact of the matter is that is a theory that requires unobtainium to actually make that work.
Yeah.
Right? But it is a solution of Einstein's.
You're not aware of anybody who's tried this at all? Or?
No, you can't. I mean, it's the same with wormholes. Like, everyone talks about wormholes and so on. And so, in theory, it is a solution of Einstein's theory of relativity, right?
Yeah.
But it's essentially impossible, as far as we were, to make a wormhole.
What's the difference between a wormhole and a black hole?
So a wormhole is a connector between two points in space that effectively gives you a shortcut.
So if we went into a wormhole, we would come out again at some point?
Yeah, so imagine taking a piece of paper and punching a hole through, connecting both sides.
Yep.
That would be like a wormhole. It's just a shorter route between a given point. Whereas a black hole is obviously very different. It's a point in space and time where essentially everything's gone to infinite density and light cannot escape.
Could we use these wormholes for space travel?
That would be the great hope.
It would be.
That would be the great hope. But like I said, we don't think it's possible to be actually create wormholes.
Have we ever tried to send a satellite into any of these wormholes? Are you aware
of
that?
We don't think it's possible to create wormholes.
Okay. I'm confused here now. You don't think they exist?
No.
Oh, really? So
but they
now
exist,
you've really got me lost.
No. They exist as a solution of Einstein's theory of relativity, but that doesn't mean they exist in nature.
Ah, okay. Right. Fascinating. I love this show. Dun, dun, dun. You learn something here. 10:46 is our time. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a question or a comment, Peter just tweeted to say he once had a coworker who wanted to believe zombies exist. He says, we're inclined to confabulate our realities, I think he says.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. 10:46, we'll be back with more with Dr. Rob right after this quick break. Coming up now to 10:49 on a Monday morning, Dr. Rob Thacker is my guest. This is Science Files, and I understand we have a special young lady on the line with us who has a question for us here. Good morning, Autumn. Hello there.
Why do we always see the moon?
Okay. And how old are you, Autumn? She's four.
Okay.
All right. So
I'm going to take that as Autumn saying, why do we always see one side of the moon?
Okay.
That's what I think she's asking about. And so the answer to that is the moon is in something that we call a tidal lock. And I'll try and explain. What happens is in the past, the moon was kind of spinning around. So you would have been able to see different pieces of it. But over a period of time, because of some complicated physics, it doesn't matter, but over a period of time, that rotation has slowed down. It's actually got a little bit further away. And now we just see one particular face of it, which is exactly the same as its rotation period. It is actually still spinning, but we always see it because as it goes around us, it keeps one face pointing towards us at the same time.
So, Adam, that's the answer. It's always one side of the moon that's always looking at the planet all the time. Do you understand that? Adam, are you there?
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, okay. Right. Well, listen, I hope that answered your question, Autumn, and I appreciate
Thanks.
The call.
Thanks,
Thank
Autumn.
You very much. So, you know, the younger they get, the better it is.
And no, it's good to be curious.
Yeah,
good
it is
to be
indeed.
Curious.
Yeah. Looking here at a pilot project using Tesla power walls to power 10 Nova Scotia homes.
Oh, this is Elmsdale,
this
right?
This is Elmsdale, yeah. Right? They had they set up these. Well, first they set up a grid-sized battery at a substation in Elmsdale.
Yeah.
Then they installed 10 Tesla power walls in these homes. And this was a pilot project. They deemed it to be a success. The bottom line is that when there's a power outage, the power walls automatically kick in. You wouldn't notice that you had a power outage. And,
yep. So,
and they're saying this could be the answer to heating or generating power in homes in the future.
There are a number of angles in this particular story as well. So one of the things that struck me when I first saw it was like $3.2 million for 10 homes. That sounds really expensive.
It does.
Right? So the cost of that is primarily in the particular grid size battery that they have, which has a potentially very large amount of power.
This is the one at the substation? Or
The one at the substation.
Okay.
So the ones in the homes, as far as I can tell, the ones in the homes are about 15,000 Canadian, right? So they're expensive, but they're not crazy expensive.
Yep.
So this is a great pilot project because you've just mentioned that if the power goes out, you've got the power in your power pack at home to keep you going, which is great. But the key thing in all of this that we tend to ignore is the fact that power from renewables is uneven, right? So whether it's solar power or wind power, you don't always get the power when you need it. So you got to store it somehow. And that is the thing that this particular power pack, as they call it, at the substation will do that. It will store this power. And then when you need more power, if you haven't or you can't generate it with your renewables, it can supply that. So this is about grid stability as well as having that sort of like battery backup at home. So this is an interesting project.
Yeah. Mark Kandow is one of the homeowners selected for this project. And he says, quote, "From my standpoint, it is essentially a quiet generator for me. The power goes out. I get a text from Tesla saying the power is out, but I don't realize the power is out because it's still going."
Yeah, that's right. I mean, because you've got that home battery and that will switch over very quickly. You might not even get a blip. And so that works really well. And the substation battery itself, as far as I'm aware, is actually fed by a wind farm in this case.
That's right. Yeah. Right? Yeah. The wind powers the substation battery and it, again, powers out the electricity or the power to the batteries.
Yeah,
so
I think where the interesting thing is here, that there are a number of companies that are trying to focus on producing cheap grid-scale batteries, right? Because you're going to need a lot of them. And so they're focusing on using commonly available elements like carbon, aluminium, aluminum. And so this is a technology that people are actively working on, whereas I think the Tesla solution is actually still pretty expensive as these go. For a lithium ion solution at home, $15,000, I think, is still quite a big chunk of change.
But knowing, again, the regularity of power outages here in this province is something to keep an eye on as a potential.
That is a concern, but this isn't going to fix that because you're still going to have power. You're still going to need power lines with this kind of setup, right? Unless you build a solar power system at home or a grid power system at home, you're still going to need some kind of connection to the grid.
And that's their hope, because I'm looking at a spokesman who says that testing the system is the first step in trying to harness and store wind energy and eventually solar power.
No. I mean, this is a huge issue. And so when people, the electrical engineers, they study the actual grid stability with a certain amount of renewables, and they've said, look, the way the grid is set up, we can't take more than sort of like 20-30% renewables at the moment. We need some kind of battery system that can actually even out the power supply as well. So that's something. And like, I hate to say it, but nuclear always comes into the discussion in this context as well as being something that you can suddenly turn on and get a lot of power from. But who knows? Maybe battery technologies will actually improve to the point where we don't need to think about that.
Okay. I think we have time for one more caller here. Let's go to Tom this morning. Hi, Tom.
How are you doing, Rick?
Good, sir. How are you today?
Not bad. I got a question there for you guys.
Go ahead, fire away.
Just two quick things. Where is the current North Pole? shifts around, and last time I heard it was somewhere closer to Whitehorse rather than up north.
Oh.
And the other thing is, how do you know the Earth's tilt is still the same?
Okay. Tom, appreciate the call.
Okay,
Dr. Rob.
So the first one, I can't remember. I do know that the magnetic pole is moving, and so people have to be careful when you go up north because of that. But I can't honestly tell you off the top of my head precisely where it is. We have to go and look at Google. But in terms of knowing the Earth's tilt, that's actually relatively straightforward to know, because we can always use, basically, if you imagine all of the stars, which are very, very, very far away, they're so far away, they're literally a reference frame, right? As you move relative to them, you can know whether the Earth's axis is tilting or not. And so that's how we do it. We can do it. That's basically something we call geodesy, right? And we can do that. We can go even farther away than stars, in fact. We can actually use radio telescopes to actually pinpoint precisely where distant, very active galaxies called quasars are. And that gives us the best way of monitoring what's happening to the Earth's tilt.
Hmm. Okay. And let's end on this note. Daryl, with one of his jokes that he sends us on a regular basis, where can planets update their status with their Facebook account? But he also wonders, how did you start off and end up choosing a career path in astrophysics?
Good question. So I've always been keen on physics. I wasn't going to do astrophysics initially. I was going to be a computer programmer. Ironically, that's what I end up doing anyway. But yeah. I was given a book by a friend's dad. He's actually quite a famous scientist now in the UK. He's a guy called John Shepherd. But anyway, so I read that and then I said, okay, I'm going to go and study physics. And I went and studied physics. And then I thought I would do stuff like Stephen Hawking does. I tried to do that. I realized I probably wasn't smart enough to do that. And so I switched to doing astrophysics, and I found the thing that I was good at. And that was computer programming and doing simulations of how galaxies form.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Dr. Rob's career in
But I've done
seconds.
Other things. I worked for a year. I took a year out. Worked in a.
You worked for a bank at some point.
I worked
point,
for a bank. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And we all had a variety of minor jobs
experience.
On our way
I
to where we are today.
Go and do something else, right? Yeah. So there's interesting jobs you can do. You don't have to sort of like be totally focused on academia, even though you might want to be a professor.
I drove cab for 6 months and played semi-pro hockey while I was figuring out what to do after I left high school. Here I am.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The hidden side.
The hidden side, indeed. Dr. Rob, we're off next week. And next Monday, of course, is a holiday. And so we'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
2 weeks' time. Okay, bye.
All right. Dr. Rob Thacker joins us every Monday at this time with Science Files. It is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break right now for a news update. And then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We're going to the phones next hour. It's time for Manic Monday. It's our first open hour of the week. Anything goes in our open hours, and our phone lines await your calls now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll take your calls after the news, and the news is coming up next.